Well, tonight we continue our consideration of the book of Esther, a book that does not have explicitly the name of God, but his handiwork, his actions are seen throughout this book, various events that show how remarkable providences were taking place in the lives of these different individuals, some of whom were believers of a kind, others of whom were rank pagans. And so the first heading tonight is this: the fruit of a rash decision. The fruit of a rash decision. King Ahasuerus, King Xerxes, this great and mighty Persian king, with his vast empire stretching there as far as India, down into Egypt, when he began to consider again and regret his decision regarding Vashti. The queen, and she was a beautiful queen too, that on the advice of these various advisers, his sort of entourage of close confidants, had decided to put away and expel from the court, never again to have her appear before him, deposing her as wife. He began to rue that decision. He was licking his wounds somewhat. He embarked upon a disastrous campaign against the Greeks, stirred up because the Ionians were refusing to recognize him and were casting off, as it were, the shackles of Persian rule. And so he came against them, but the rest of the Greeks came there to defend the Ionians. And the result was, though there were some early victories for the Persians, defeat ultimately. Though he had brought together and amassed a vast army. And we recall this feasting that was there laid on to bring the various satraps, the governors there, into a way of thinking supportive of this military campaign. Despite all of that, the campaign had failed, and he had returned, therefore, a rather chastened individual. And now, maybe when he was looking for some comfort, some friendship, which perhaps Vashti used to offer him, of course, she is no longer there as a comforter to him. So he begins to rue, regret the decision that he has made, perhaps. And a little bit may be, like another king, a king here of Israel, King Rehoboam, who, when asked whether he was going to continue the somewhat heavy-handed regime that his father Solomon had latterly been introducing, taxation, requirements there that he laid upon the Israelites, replied, "Well, in effect, if you thought my father was bad, you haven't seen anything yet. I'm going to introduce more than that." And the result was, well, the foolish counsel that had been given to him by young men, whereas the wiser heads had said, "No, listen to the people, listen to this man Jeroboam, who was representing there a fair number of the tribes, they became the northern tribes, and take on board what they're saying and offer them somewhat of a more peaceful and a more gracious regime." Well, he ignored that advice, of course, followed the young men's advice, and the result was he lost most of his kingdom. Well, bad decisions, and these are taken often there because bad advice is given, inadequate advice. And we can see how, throughout the Bible, there are various people who give bad advice. Well, it might appear good advice at the time, but essentially it is bad advice because it's going against the will of God. Shrewd advice, but morally deficient advice. There's another character from that sort of period, Ahithophel, advising Absalom, that rebellious son of David, acting now against his father, trying to seize the crown, causing his father great grief. That they, David, and his company of loyal people had to flee the city, fleeing for his life. And Ahithophel, looking now to capitalize on this and advising, "Go get him now, follow up this, and you'll find him in a weakened state." Well, it was actually shrewd and good advice. Had not Hushai been in the city there to sort of stop that and stop Absalom in his tracks and appeal to his pride and say, "Oh no, give time, let's gather together more people and go at the head of a triumphant army." because he knew that in that time, that breathing space, David would be able to recover somewhat and regain a little bit of advantage there and be ready for his son Absalom's attack. So Ahithophel's advice failed at that point. It was shrewd advice, sure it was, but morally deficient advice, morally inadequate advice, much as the advisors around King Xerxes there had not advised him particularly well. And there's a lesson for us here. Choose your friends wisely. Choose them wisely. There are people who will give us advice, and lots of people there are tripping over themselves to give advice. Any number of Christian books on the bookshelf, just brimming with advice. It astonishes me how quick people are to give advice or speak forth what they think is happening there. And often, as events prove them to be absolutely wrong in what they were saying, I never read of them backtracking on what they said or apologizing for what they had done. And there are people who would be just happy to flatter us. So it's good to have friends, not just those who will agree with us, but maybe challenge us and provoke us in some way there to reflect. For we need always to think through the implications of our decisions. Well, King Ahasuerus might have looked kind of powerful by having his wife Vashti there sort of banished and sent away, might have appealed to his pride and manliness, but in the end it wasn't a particularly good decision. He then left himself without a wife, maybe a wise wife, maybe an Abigail of a wife there in Vashti. And so now, when he has had this defeat, he's left bereft, and it was not a happy time for him. They are always important decisions that we take, big decisions, and we have to think through the implications and work out some scenarios and pray through these matters before we embark upon them. And always remember this, acts of vengeance have shown themselves again and again to be issues there that never end happily. Nations that have taken revenge on other nations or various ethnic groups that have they're gone against another ethnic group. Oh, throughout history, these things can fester away, never then disappear, always likely to be stoked again and inflamed again, and troubles follow. It's often these kinds of decisions, decisions that are made on the basis of national pride or something like that, leave a legacy that centuries later is still bubbling away, still a foment of it, and likely to boil over and cause further grief. See it in Ukraine, don't we, and elsewhere. Seen it in the Balkans in general. Past grievances that then come back to haunt them and lead to the loss of many lives. Rash decisions, the fruit of rash decisions. We have to be careful. Review the implications. Think it through. Xerxes didn't. Here he is now facing this sad emptiness in his life on returning from this disastrous military campaign. For now, my second heading. An apparent disaster. An apparent disaster. We see here, now in chapter 2, the bringing together of two worlds. I should say the title of the sermon is Good Character in the Midst of Adversity. Good Character in the Midst of Adversity. We're going to begin to see how that works out. Here is what seems to be an apparent disaster. This world that so far, in the narrative of Esther, we've been living in, world of this Persian court and this great king, lavish feasts that are being laid on and great decisions being made there, foolish decisions in the case of banishing his wife. So advisors, these great and dignified men. Well, that world is set to collide with an entirely different world. There's going to be a remarkable intersection of worlds that would not normally ever have met together. For what has happened now? Well, the king has received fresh advice. Those advisors, perhaps some of them the same advisors, who had caused the king to embark on this rash decision and to put away Vashti as his wife. Well, now, they must be beginning to think this could be bad for us. The king now is in a bad mood, and he is a very unhappy despot. And our position is rather insecure, because if he begins to ask himself, well, who gave me this advice? He'll be looking at us, and we're staring down the barrel of a gun, if you will. So they here intervene with, again, some advice of their own. And so this grumpy despot, and we understand he had embarked somewhat from the history books we learn on some wild living in that time. These advisers suggest a way in which he can find a new wife. And they organise, well, what is in effect, this beauty parade. Throughout the whole provinces of all the Persian Empire, that there is going to be a bringing in of all the most beautiful women that could be found. And amongst them, surely they thought, one would stand out and would make the king happy. And when the king is happy, then our danger that we ourselves may be impaled or hung for having given him this advice in the first place that's left him unhappy, maybe by then he's forgotten that, and he'll be happy, and our position will be safe and secure. So maybe something of that was in their minds. Under this calling together of all these various women, this bringing them in from north, south, east, and west, subjecting them to these beauty treatments, well, if these women did not succeed in pleasing the king, then they were just handed over to another department, as it were, within the palace, where they just remain. They wouldn't be able to marry, wouldn't be able to marry anybody else. They'd just be what we might call concubines within the household of the king, which was not a particularly good outcome for them. So there was a high risk involved in all of this, that if you did not succeed in pleasing the king, that was your destiny. Well, this action here began to take effect. And this edict and this effort to call in from far and anywhere near women to participate in this began to happen. This is where the collision of these two worlds takes place. And so we have this world of the king, mighty Persian Empire, this vast area, notwithstanding their losses there at the hands of Greece, but still a long way away from its defeat and decline, no, still exercising immense power. The king there, a great sort of despot and having almost unlimited wealth and resources, that world now begins to touch with the world of a Jewish family. And a Jewish family with rather a sad background. There is this young woman who is an orphan, and she is being looked after by her uncle. Here we are introduced, aren't we, to Mordecai. They live in Shushan, Susa, and Mordecai, the son of Jair, who is a Benjaminite. It's thought by some that his family had gone back to Jerusalem under the edict of Cyrus and then returned again, but we can't be sure on that particular fact. And he had brought up there very much as a kindly uncle, this niece, the name Hadassah. And that means myrtle, the flower of the myrtle, forming there a star shape so that her name in Persian, Esther, meant star. Esther, star. That derived from her Jewish name. There she was, by all accounts there as well, a most beautiful young woman. And Mordecai was there, obviously very protective of her, caring for her, her mother and father having died. But now there is an invasion into that world. Now, well, we don't know exactly how it happens, but it happens. And this world of the Persian king and all his entourage now interferes with, intervenes in, this world of this modest, humble Jewish family. Well, what was the reason for this intersection? Was it that she offered herself? Her family, or Mordecai, said, you know, there's a beauty contest, let's get in touch now. You know, you hear of some competition or other, I'm going to write in now and make sure that my niece gets sort of taken up in this. Well, perhaps it was, in which case we're surprised at that, and Marvel at that, because intermarriage with pagans by Jews was frowned upon, very much frowned upon. Or maybe it was that she was recommended by others, maybe not Jews, but people that had seen her. Ah, she's a likely candidate. She might be pleasing to the eye of the king. And that, therefore, some representative of the king had come and urged them and made it very difficult for them to refuse. Or maybe it was stronger than that. She had been virtually taken, almost kidnapped. But here, the Jews in their state of exile, and with the urgency of the king's needs there, that there was no etiquette, and she was basically almost forcibly taken. We always think there, don't we, of Boko Haram and taking away those girls and kidnapping them. Well, maybe it had something of that feature to it. We see here maybe that beauty is not always a great asset. Beauty is not always a great asset. Great help there, some women testify. Well, gives them confidence and power, opens doors for them maybe in business. But it also generates a lot of unwanted attention. And the wrong people can show interest. The wrong men of not good character, lust and so forth, being their main motivation rather than love. So many celebrities there, you know, record how they had unhappy marriages and how these sad and loveless marriages there ended in divorce or some such thing, or partnerships that broke down after a fairly short while. And some of these women there break away from that. We hear some, don't we, become lesbians and things. And that is remarkable in itself. What sadness attends them, what misery. And so there is a downside there to the whole issue of beauty. Well, I guess some of our women folk there, we may be tempted to envy some of these people and the success that comes from it, but there is a downside. But these worlds, having been brought into conflict, having been sort of brought together by this remarkable providence, what appears then an apparent disaster. Let's think of it like that, as though maybe she had been just sort of taken, collared, and whisked away, and that Mordecai would not have approved of this or wanted this, nor Esther either. But we remember, apparent disasters are always such. And here we think back perhaps to Joseph, being taken there forcibly, having been sold as a slave, and the brothers having kindly, well, withdrawn their desire to kill him. No, they think, we'll sell him for some money. The Midianite traders happen to be passing by, and Joseph finding himself taken away down to Egypt. And then the troubles he has there, how the ups and the downs go, and finds himself in prison. But of course, eventually finds himself, interesting isn't it here, in a palace, much like Esther is destined to do. So, apparent, let's underline the word apparent, apparent disasters can actually be here matters where God is going to surprise us remarkably. And we should never despair, whatever situation we're in, whatever the circumstances, never despair. God may be doing something quite remarkable. No despair. He's not forgotten us, not turned his back on us. We're not forsaken. And there may be something yet that will turn out for our good in a most incredible and remarkable way, as we're going to learn, of course, in the case of Esther, and has happened in the case of Joseph. Well, now, I'm coming very much nearer to the title of the sermon tonight. Our third heading is this, the blessings of good character. The blessings of good character. Now, Esther, having been brought into the palace and put under the charge of Hegai, is now subject to beauty treatments for a whole year. Well, this may have been something that she actually hated and did not want, did not desire. We may think this is wonderful ourselves there. I don't know. A whole year of beauty treatments, the sort of thing that you might win in a magazine or something like that. But anyway, this is something that Esther would not have chosen for herself. This was not something that she desired. And we might imagine that the whole atmosphere there in the palace, in that area where they were awaiting their turn to go into the king, generated a fair amount of jealousy. itchiness, nastiness, a pecking order, and efforts to pull one down and kind of vaunt one's own beauty in comparison with theirs. Very, very nasty in a very ungodly atmosphere. There is Esther, stuck in the middle of this, tipped into this, having been one moment, as it were, there with Mordecai, as a modest lifestyle, humble kind of origins, and now brought into the palace, and here in this world of this comparisons and of pride and all of the kind of things that would have been maybe very much on display. Very evil, very worldly, a very wicked kind of environment, bringing out the worst in people there. Comparisons that are being made. Oh dear, we see that, don't we, in the world today, and what poor women are subject to there, what they wear. Are there any women there that reads the news or gives the weather forecast? It's what they're wearing. If they wear the same dress that they wore a year ago, and this becomes a subject there of great debate. Really, we'd be better off that didn't have to happen. We just listen to what the woman's saying when she reads the news or gives the weather forecast. And of course, ahead of them, this rather carnal prospect of a night with the king in his company and seeing whether they were pleasing to him. And as I already mentioned, if it didn't work out, if they didn't please him, then they would just be consigned to another area of the palace and put under there the power, as it were, of Shazgaz, the other man who occupied some position in regard to these women, the king's eunuch, another one, who kept the concubines, those who'd failed the test and were now, maybe, the king might call upon them every now and then, but basically they had failed. The rest of their life would be there, remaining in that situation, never a prospect of marrying. But with Esther, maybe beyond any other of the women that had passed through under Haggai's kind of watchful eye, one stood out, and that was Esther. She, we read about it in verse 9, something there that pleased Haggai. Something about her, and others, and too, were able to appreciate that, and Haggai and his comment there in that particular way. And she stood out. There was something there remarkable about her. She stood out. And again, that's commented upon in verse 15. A good report, maybe, that Haggai was able to give. So that even maybe there, before the women went into the king, there'd be a sort of CV that he would receive, some report that was given to him in advance, so that he was able to sort of consider the person in the light of that particular thing. It was more, I'd suggest, than beauty. Character. Her character. The way in which she carried herself. Her behaviour, her deportment in this very, perhaps catty, bitchy environment, bringing out the worst in many of these women. But no, it didn't bring out anything of that kind in her. And that Haggai was able, perhaps, to see this and consider this, and he offered her some extra help in that regard. Different kinds of treatments, and helping her when it came to her interview with the king. Special advice, something extra that he provided her with that would give her there some advantage. Kinds of things in her character might have stood out. Well, things like this, perhaps modesty, that she wasn't advancing her own claims there, or elbowing out others, or speaking about them behind their backs or to their faces, tearing them off a strip, giving them the piece of advice there. No. Perhaps modesty, a degree of humility, not boasting about herself and her beauty. No, rather perhaps a cheerfulness under quite adverse circumstances, quite difficult things. And something else, perhaps, a faith in God. A faith, something that she believed, something beyond where she was, that none of the other women had displayed. And maybe something of these attitudes and these aspects of her character shone through and impressed Haggai, that he could see there was something different about her. We read a moment back in 1 Peter chapter 3. Just to read again the opening 6 verses there. Wives, it says, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct, accompanied by fear. Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather let it be the hidden person of the heart, and the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good, not afraid with any terror. Something of this. Not her relying upon their, there must have been a lot of arranging the hair and wearing gold and putting on fine apparel, but no, something of the hidden person of the heart, the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. And this may well have stood out and impressed Haggai. Something that came through, something of her fear of God, her respect for him, her trust in him, a gentle and a quiet spirit. Or in 1 Timothy chapter 3, there in verse 11, wives of deacons, likewise their wives must be reverent, not slanderous, temperate, faithful in all things. Not slanderous. Though they weren't gossiping, weren't sort of tearing other women apart there, not sort of speaking of them there, and maligning them when they weren't there, or as I say, when they actually were there, and indulging there in put-downs and sarcasm. No, reverence and a temperate way, and a faithfulness, being there, willing to help perhaps in various ways. Proud, not arrogant, not self-seeking, different than the other women, standing out, her character. And so, although Esther had great beauty, and that she could have traded on that, but she didn't. And instead, there she was, demonstrating something very different, and received extra help from Haggai. We see that in verse 9. And then, famously, she also impresses the king. When it comes to her time to go, and Haggai has prepared her for this, he's done a bit more, gone the extra mile for her, so that when it comes to her time to go in, he's given her some counsel, some special advice, as well as special potions and extra kind of things there to beautify her. Perhaps also that advice. And she, with that quiet spirit, has listened carefully, understood, learnt perhaps there, Haggai, given some inside track about what the king's about and how to address him and how to speak to him and what his interests are, gone the extra mile for her because of his love for her. He's perhaps seen that something in her that has drawn out his own respect. And she, then following that advice, more than the beauty that she has, perhaps we might say, wins the king's heart in verse 17. The king, smitten by her, yes, her beauty, readily concede that, but more than that, her character that's coming through, perhaps a good report that he's already had there to bending his ear from the place, the quarters where she's kept. And now, sudden promotion. And now, from that modest, humble home, she is now brought to be the queen, given the crown of this vast Persian empire, this huge expanse of area covering all so much there into Asia, into Africa, there located in the Middle East. Her character had led to her advance. Valuable. And we must, just the women folk here, but all of us, learn to cultivate it. Learn to build up and seek out there the means for the development of good character. And just a few thoughts in that regard. Reliability. Reliability. If we can be people that can be relied upon, That speaks well of us. If we say we'll do something, we do it. If we are saying we'll be there at a particular time, we'll be there at a particular time. We'll aim to be there at that time. Honesty. Known to be honest, genuine, honest people. And that is always something there that will bring a good testimony regarding us. Modesty. In an age where people are brash and speak up their own stock, no, modesty actually stands out. And modesty, in the end, is often something people appreciate more. And though it be a world of self-assertiveness, a modest person can often receive more accolade and promotion and reward than those who are loud. Often those who are loud may get on for a while, but then, something of their emptiness will come through. They'll make some huge mistake. They'll upset so many people that it's time for them to be moved on. Humility. Humility. These are the kinds of qualities that can be very, very valuable. Luke chapter 14, verses 8 to 11. This is a parable the Lord told there. When you're invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest one more honourable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you, and him come and say to you, give place to this man. And then you begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit down in the lowest place, so that when he who invited you comes, he may say to you, friend, go up higher. Then you will have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. And that principle isn't just for them. It's not just a culturally kind of confined to that period sort of thing. Oh, no. That is a principle for all ages. That works today, works in all ages. So this is a principle here the Lord Jesus taught. Cheerfulness in adversity, faithfulness, gentleness. Well, these were the features, perhaps, that won Esther the king's heart and won her a crown, and perhaps for us as well, and for our young people, may yet for us be a source there of great encouragement and help as we move on in our own seeking out the Lord's will. Well, fourth and final heading, hiding who we are. Hiding who we are. Well, Esther conceals her identity. And this at the bidding of Mordecai. Well, maybe there was danger to her if she didn't, or rather if she did reveal her identity as a Jew, as a member there, not of a Persian kind of people, a Mede or a Persian, but from being one of those exiles, the Jews. Maybe there was some danger in that. It seems in this whole process that she wasn't asked for a background, so she didn't tell what her background was. And this only comes clear later on. But this is sometimes perhaps prudent to do, to not reveal who we are, not to volunteer that information. And we can think, can't we, perhaps there of Islamic countries where it's very, very dangerous to let on that we are Christians or to attempt to witness. And these things can sometimes be prudent. But by and large, that is not the best policy. Not the best policy. And the reasons here, whether Mordecai particularly was right to give this counsel is debatable, and whether Esther was right to hear that counsel and follow that counsel is also debatable. We have to be clear about who we are. Scripture does not commend those who hide their discipleship. John chapter 12 and verses 42 and 43, nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. Loving the praise of men more than the praise of God. That was what more was of interest to them. That they, as it were, discounted all that there was in eternity for them, and the blessings there of God's approval upon them, because they wanted in present time the approval of men. A sort of cowardly fear, in effect. There's no compliment there in hiding our identity from the Lord. So, better. Be clear, be upfront, be direct, be natural about it. Explain, needs be. This is who you are. You're comfortable being a Christian. You're comfortable to tell them that you are a Christian, even if they're rather uncomfortable in hearing that from you. Otherwise, it makes us appear sneaky. It makes us appear perhaps underhand. It reveals a fearfulness that really there is not fitting for a Christian. It dishonors God, for he is much higher than any earthly power, much mightier, much greater. It saves problems later on because it avoids potential compromises that we might otherwise find ourselves in. Often there, we're Christians, so people just won't ask us to be involved in things that are underhand and various degrees of immorality involved. We don't end up having to be complicit. Of course, sometimes things don't work out like that, and we still find ourselves having to make a stand within the decision-making of unbelievers. Sometimes it works that people then don't swear around us, or if they do, they apologize. And so, to be clear about our Christian testimony, can often avoid various problems and embarrassment. They can also watch us, because this often puts them on alert. We're Christians, they're going to watch us. And maybe there we can commend the Lord to them by having there set before them a good impression that we're Christians, we've confessed the Lord, so they're watching us. They'd like to undermine us if they can. They'd like to be able to heap some insult upon us. But if, of course, we're living consistently, then there's a good impression. Character is coming through, and they'll find it very difficult to be negative about us. And maybe it even causes them to begin to search their own soul, begin to ask themselves questions, those who are nominal Christians and really not clear in their adherence to the gospel. Well, it might there create great embarrassment to them. And they realize that their own testimony is threadbare compared with ours, and that they wouldn't stand up for the Lord. This would not be something that they would pin everything on. They much prefer to be under the radar there and not stake too much or put too much at stake regarding their career. It might there cause them to think a little bit about whether they really are Christians. But anyway, whatever the rights and wrongs of Esther at this particular time, it most certainly ensures that she, under God's guiding hand, is in the right place at the right time, as we shall see as we proceed in later weeks.